This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson and a movie review from Matt O'Lean. But first, my colleague Craig Blumenschein joins me to talk about this spring member drive. Hey, Craig.
We are working today, Ashley, really hard for our spring pledge drive. We're hoping that listeners connect with us, and today is a great day to do it because a dollar gets us $2. Ashley, a pledge $10 monthly.
What kind of magic are you talking about?
We match pledges dollar for dollar today, and we hope that our listeners will reach out to us. It's so easy to do. 800-359-4145. We're ready to answer the phone right now, or you can go to our website at prairiepublic.org. We think our listeners are important, Ashley, and we hope they feel that way, and that they hope, or that we hope then that they choose to pledge their support for us right here at Prairie Public.
So anybody who isn't familiar with these member drives, here's what we're doing. Perhaps you've noticed we're not airing commercials during the day. And in what that means is we can't sell that commercial space to advertisers. And instead, we ask you, our listeners, to become members. It's easy to do. You can go online to prairiepublic.org, or you can pick up that phone and call 800-359-4145. And Craig, these matching dollar things that you mentioned earlier, what we do is we ask certain members to say, hey, if we can get a few more people on the line here for supporting this service, would you consider donating more? And these amazing superheroes, you know, not all superheroes wear capes, some of them invest in public broadcasting a little bit more, have said, yeah, we will put up an extra $4,000. So don't let that $4,000 sit on the table here unanswered. Make your pledge of support now online at prairiepublic.org, or you can call 800-359-4145.
And as you consider pledging today, remember that matching offer is just for today. So as you consider whether to give to Prairie Public or not, think about that. And also think beyond the value you receive. Think about the value that Prairie Public delivers to our community. Our community is your community. We'll use your gift for better programming, for supporting public radio here in North Dakota and the Prairie region. 800-359-4145. Ashley?
And when you come in at $30 a month, we're going to roll out the red carpet for you and a guest to enjoy the Moth main stage. Like here, get this, we're already playing the Moth. We already have tickets for you to go to the Moth. And then at $30 a month, you get to go to this private post-event party. So whatever is your reason for supporting, let us know now at prairiepublic.org, or pick up that phone, 800-359-4145, and get this special event to the Moth.
All right, Ashley, let's turn our attention to today's show. We'll review the news with our news director, Dave Thompson, and Matt O'Lean stops by for his weekly check-in on the movies. Matt has a lot to say about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes this week. That will all be in the second half of today's show, but first, my visit with educator Darcy Bakkegaard. She is working to reinvent how teachers are trained via their access to professional development. She's a former teacher, mother of triplets, and now working to bring joy to teachers and their vocation of preparing our young people right here in North Dakota. Darcy, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. I'm excited to be here and share all things education.
We are happy that you're here. Such an important topic. And teachers and teacher development, not only in North Dakota, is a big topic. Darcy, you used to be a teacher in the classroom.
Yeah.
Tell me about your background with education.
Sure. I was a high school English and theater teacher for 11 years. I taught in Wisconsin. I taught here in North Dakota. I taught in Istanbul. And I love the energy in classrooms. I love working with kids. And as I transitioned out of the classroom, I wanted to help teachers find that same energy and passion and keep that energy for education going for other educators. And so I've shifted who I'm serving and who I'm helping, but I'm still teaching. Now I teach teachers.
How do you do that?
I host a variety of workshops and classes. I help facilitate Prairie Public's Amplifying Student Voices class. It's an introductory class to how to use media in the classroom, how to increase media literacy skills. And this Amplifying Student Voices class, we have had every kind of teacher take this class. Kindergarten teachers through sixth grade teachers, business, gym, ag teachers, shop teachers. I have had every discipline of educator take this class and find value and how they can further amplify their student voices. I do that as much as I can by designing a playground that allows teachers to play with ideas and to think about what is going to bring joy for them as an educator, what tickles their fancy and keeps them energized, but also what is going to get students excited and what is going to allow students to think about authentic problems and then create authentic artifacts of their learning.
Off microphone, Darcy, you shared with me that professional development really hasn't reached folks as maybe it's intended to.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really focused on. You said you got more out of dusting your shelves, getting ready for the class year, than the professional development classes you took when you were a teacher. Expand on that a little bit.
Sure. That was my at worst experience, that I would sit there feeling like, okay, this might be interesting and relevant to some of my colleagues, but it has nothing to do with what I do in my classroom. For whatever reason, it was content I had just read a whole book about or I had learned. So I understand that serving a variety of educators is tough, but in the classroom, we talk a lot about differentiation and how you need to differentiate content to different students' skill levels and to different interest levels. And yet professional development wasn't doing that. It was just everyone gets the same thing, no matter how long you've been teaching, no matter what you teach. So that differentiation that teachers are expected to implement in the classroom wasn't there for them. And I always felt like that was a little disrespectful of there's only so much time in a day, and I already give up so much of my personal time as an educator. I want my professional development to be meaningful and relevant because, as I said to you before, I'm a dork. I love learning about new things. And so I really want great professional development. And I've been very fortunate in my education career to experience some really stellar professional development and get amazing ideas and inspiration. But even those experiences fell short because I would get these ideas and be so fired up, but then I would go back to my classroom. I would go back to my house. And there was no follow-up. There was no implementation support. But it made me think about how can we create that differentiated, personalized learning experience for teachers that also helps them actually implement their amazing ideas to improve teaching and learning.
You've co-authored the Startup Teacher Playbook.
Yep.
What is that?
It is my partner Michelle and I's response to that very problem. How do you personalize any professional development so that you take the inspiration nuggets out of even mediocre PD and really focus on problem solving in your classroom? When you think about it, who is in the best position to enact change in education? And I'm super biased because I was a classroom teacher and I work with teachers, so I get to see how amazing they are every day. But no one is in a better position than teachers. And yet so often we wait for these top-down, one-size-fits-all solutions to education's challenges, and then we expect teachers to do it. And instead, we want to flip that and start with the teacher. Start with the educators as catalysts for change. And the Startup Teacher Playbook gives them a series of tools to identify problems in their classroom and then design and quickly test possible solutions. So it taps into a lot of things that in the business community and in the social startup world are common knowledge of how do you use design thinking and how do you tap into user input. These things that if you're from a business background are very obvious. But teachers rarely receive that kind of training. And for sure, our professional development is not set up with that framework around it. And it's such a simple, cheap way to enhance any professional development and take even mediocre professional development up several notches by tapping into the unique inspiration and spark that every individual teacher is going to get, and then helping them implement an innovation in the classroom.
What concerns you most, I guess, about how educators are being taught today prior to stepping into the classroom for the very first time?
Well, what concerns me most about that is actually how few people are seeking out training to become educators. You hear a lot of information about the teacher shortage in North Dakota and across the country, and the teacher retirement rate remains pretty stable. Where we're seeing the biggest decline is actually people entering teacher training programs.
Let's ask you there.
Yeah.
Why is that?
There are so many reasons why that's true. First, I think there's a general negativity.
About teachers? Or about the vocation?
I think about teachers in our society. When I think about growing up, I grew up in Valley City, North Dakota. People who were teachers in our community were highly respected, trusted, and just really valued members of the community. And all too often now, what you see and hear, and granted, it's a minority of very loud voices, but there's a lot about distrust of teachers, taking control away from teachers, trying to standardize things so that individual teachers can't think, and just giving them a set of instructions that they are required to just follow lock, stock. And it feels like in the last 4 years, there's been a significant decreased trust in educators. So if I'm a young person, so there's that issue. Now, if I'm a young person who's grown up in a gig economy, post-pandemic, where virtual work and being able to, you know, telecommute and all of these things have really become second nature. We all figured out how to do that by force through the pandemic. If I'm in that era and I could be making $35,000, $40,000 as a teacher, and I have to be in the building from 7:30 to 4:30 every day, and this is a standard joke, but it's also really true, where you don't even have control of when you get to go to the bathroom in the course of a day. Because if you're an elementary school teacher, it's illegal for you to leave your kids unattended. And so for me, I was a high school teacher, but I had to wait until my prep period, right? There's not enough time usually between classes. So if you taught three or four classes in a row, like,
you're there.
You're just there. So if I'm a young person and I grow up in this gig economy reality, why would I take a job for $40,000 a year where I'm locked into this schedule? Yes, there's the allure of the summers off that everybody talks about for teachers, but why would I do that when I could make that much money or more working wherever I want, whenever I want? So I do think that the gig economy and the flexibility of the average workspace is a big detractor. And when you're 20 or 18 deciding what you're going to major in, you're not necessarily looking at, well, who still has good retirement packages? And who, like, what careers give me, you know, the long-term stability? Because education still does a pretty good job in that sphere. All you see in the media is how hard teaching is. And it is hard. But what we're missing, and the story that I really want to help emphasize, and what I want to help teachers really reclaim, is education is an act of joy. It is exciting and meaningful, and it is one of the few careers where you truly have an immense purpose. And as an educator, you can serve as a catalyst for change and really and truly change the world, because you are helping equip the kids of the future with the skills we need them to have in order to solve the world's greatest problems.
Very much enjoying our conversation with Darcy Bakkegaard. We're talking about teaching and teaching today and professional development. She has authored, co-authored the book, The Startup Teacher Playbook. And Darcy, you said the word joy a minute ago, and you also have the Joy Lab.
Yes.
What is that?
It is literally going to be a lab for teachers to come and play around with joy. So my idea in my head is that we need to get our hands dirty, so to speak, with playing with joy. Because the reality is, joy is a unique thing that the more you cultivate joy for others, the more joy you receive, right? So we can really be actively cultivating joy and focusing on how do we bring joy to the people around us, and that helps fuel our own internal joy. Joy has also been proven to be one of the best stress reducers. In her book, The Stress Prescription, Dr. Elisa Eppa talks about how joy is a buffer. And joy for me is even more specific than just being happy. I always say there's two ingredients that I've identified for joy. There has to be a concrete task, something that you're working on that you can complete. And that task needs to be in service of someone. Now that someone can be yourself, right? And it can be as simple as, wow, that last delectable bite of cheesecake.
That I made, maybe?
Yes. And I am going to really focus on enjoying that moment. And my task is just eating it. And it's of service to myself and all of my senses. And I just feel this burst of joy through doing that.
How can they take advantage of the Joy Lab?
The Joy Lab is going to be here in Fargo on July 30th. They can sign up through going to bit.ly/joylabfargo, capital J, L, and F on those, and sign up for the event. There is continuing education credit associated with the workshop.
Professional development credit.
Yeah, yes. And so teachers will be able to come work on something that has maybe been bugging them, something that is reducing their joy and stress and increasing their stress, and take control of some aspect of what they're going through as an educator and design a solution. But instead of doing that in the isolation of their kitchen, you know, sometime this summer, they'll be able to do it in a collaborative, supportive environment where we will help give each other ideas, we will share those struggles, and you'll be with a group of educators who get it.
Darcy, let me ask you this question. Are you confident in the future of public schools, or does the rise, it seems, of the numbers of private schools away from the public school system that you really want to impact concern you?
I am very hopeful because I firmly believe that every child needs a great education. And I say that because society needs the genius of each of those kids. And if we aren't tapping into the collective genius of everybody in all of its different forms, because genius is not always easy to recognize and it comes in different ways and strengths, but some of those unexpected geniuses are exactly what we're gonna need, because we don't know what the future job market is going to look like. Things are changing so fast now that we cannot say accurately what kids who are in kindergarten right now, what their jobs are going to be when they grow up. Think of the number of jobs that exist now that did not exist in the 80s when I was going to school. And so we need everyone. So I feel very passionately about supporting all teachers, regardless of where they're teaching, but really empowering public schools, especially in a state like North Dakota, where rural communities, our schools are the heart of our communities. And they can act as catalysts for joy and change and energy within their communities. And we have to empower those educators, especially in rural communities, to do that work and stay in the classroom, in those places, teaching the kids what we need for the future.
Where can people learn more about your work, Darcy?
They can go to theeducatorslab.org. and learn more about what we do at the Educators Lab, what I do. Feel free to reach out to me at darcy@educatorslab.io. I genuinely love talking about education, and anyone who wants to have a brainstorming session, I do that just because it brings me so much joy. So reach out and I will happily just brainstorm away a problem with you in your classroom, or if you're an administrator, brainstorm with you how to improve professional development and create a culture of joy in your school.
Darcy Backegaard, she has created the Educators Lab. She's authored the Startup Teacher Playbook, and she's hosting the Joy Lab this summer. Darcy, thanks for joining us on Main Street, and good luck with empowering teachers.
Thank you.
Ashley Thornburg joins me. I'm Craig Blumenschein in our Fargo studios. And Ashley, it is so comforting to know that there are passionate people committed to excellence in education and teaching our educators so that they can lead young people right here in North Dakota.
I'm sitting here listening to this, and when she says schools are the heart of our communities, I'm thinking about my parents in Walhalla who, you know, I'm pushing 41 here. I haven't been in high school in a very long time. My parents are still going to high school sporting events in Walhalla because that is the thing that you do. You rally around the townsfolk there. And then hearing her talk about the collective genius of everyone and the way that, you know, somebody might have incredible emotional intelligence or athletic intelligence or the ability to be a great fact memorizer or a problem solver, and that each one of those is a valid type of intelligence, and the way that she speaks so passionately about honoring all of that just gives me so much hope for the future of our education system. And, you know, we hope that you have that same kind of hope right here in public broadcasting and are willing to support that with your investment. It happens a couple of different ways. The most popular is to go online, prairiepublic.org. Make your donation there. You can also pick up that phone and call 800-359-4145 and think about the many reasons to support public broadcasting.
Ashley, you and I are really blessed. We get to visit with people like Darcy day in and day out and not confine our conversation to a 20-second soundbite or a 30-second soundbite. We get to dig in to understand people's passions. I've always said the people that I enjoy visiting with the most are people who are passionate about whatever they do.
Yep.
That's why we hope that our listeners support public radio, hope that they believe in it just like we do, and that they go online right now to make a secure, safe, and convenient contribution pledge to Prairie Public. Our website is prairiepublic.org. Ashley, there's never been a better time then now to pledge your support to Prairie Public.
Bum, 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 because we have this member challenge, an extra $4,000 on the table for members here. As if the programming isn't incentive enough, here is your opportunity to get your investment matched online at prairiepublic.org or by calling 800-359-4145. Still to come, we have our discussion with Dave Thompson and a news review. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service recently announced it's discontinuing a few industry surveys. The department is canceling its July cattle report, the cotton objective yield survey, and all county estimates for crops and livestock starting with this production year. Those surveys are used by researchers and those in the ag industry. But Ben Brown, a University of Missouri Extension economist and research analyst, says USDA is having to make tough decisions. He says cuts have been seen across USDA agencies.
Some of the other agencies have discontinued grant opportunities that they have done with cooperators, so like cooperative agreements. And so costs are going up, and USDA is handling that in a variety of different ways, right?
Brown says there have been survey lapses in the past, and the surveys could be brought back. A new round of federal funding is coming North Dakota's way to help plug dozens of abandoned oil wells. Here's Mike Moan.
The U.S. Department of the Interior this week awarded $25 million to North Dakota to respond to what's described as legacy pollution. 46 orphaned oil and gas wells will be plugged, along with remediation work in more than 270 contaminated sites. The funding is tied to the federal bipartisan infrastructure law. Curtis Shuck leads the Well Done Foundation, which works with states on capping neglected wells no longer in operation. He says this work is vital in reducing negative environmental impacts, such as lingering methane leaks.
End of the day, when we walk away from a project, it's hopefully like it was never there.
Beyond protecting air and water resources, federal officials say these projects create good-paying union jobs and pave the way for economic growth. A number of conservation groups say while these efforts are needed, oil companies that abandon these sites are being let off the hook. At the very least, they say more regulations are needed to prevent these situations. On the economic front, Shuck says restoring the land underneath these wells benefits the agricultural sector by giving farmers more acreage to work with.
In places like North Dakota or in Montana where we started, the farmer doesn't have to play dodgeball.
He says farmers can be more efficient with their operational costs by not having to plow around an abandoned well. Observers say despite enhanced efforts to address the issue, the U.S. has a lot of catching up to do with roughly 130,000 documented orphaned wells out there on the landscape. In the initial round of program funding, North Dakota used its share to plug 73 wells. This is Mike Bowen for Prairie News Service.
And Basin Electric Power Cooperative plans to build another natural gas-fired power generation facility in North Dakota. The North Dakota Monitor reports Basin CEO Todd Brickhouse revealed the plans while speaking on a panel at the Williston Basin Petroleum Conference in Bismarck. Brickhouse said it would be a 1,400-megawatt power-generating facility and become the utility cooperative's largest power-generating facility. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
We hear that music from Bill Haley and his comments, and that means Dave Thompson, our news director, is back with us here on Main Street. Dave, welcome.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
We've had a busy week, a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. We're pledging or asking people to support Prairie Public right now. We urge people to go online to prairiepublic.org and make their connection with us. We would really appreciate that, Dave, but we're going to review the news here just a little bit. Some new EPA rules you've talked about might mean power grid reliability issues right here in North Dakota. What's right. The latest there?
Well, the latest is that these rules are to reduce mercury emissions, CO2 emissions, and basically they're giving power plants a choice. Either you find a way to sequester carbon, that carbon dioxide, or you're going to shut the plant down if it's a coal-fired plant. They're saying that, yeah, we've got sequestration projects going. However, they're not ready to be mass produced, if you want to say that. We've got the Project Tundra here in North Dakota, and they're working on that. And things are looking good right now, but they're not ready to, you know, make it prime time in power plants.
Yeah, CO2 capture has been a thing. It's been talked about for over a decade. But really, it's yet to be proven on a large scale yet to
That's
be cost
correct.
Effective, Dave.
That is correct.
We move on now to cities and towns. Cities are working to replace their old lead water service lines. This is a problem for every city in the country.
I think that's right. At least we've got this infrastructure revolving loan fund, $56 million from the bipartisan infrastructure bill for the years 2022 and 2023 is helping that revolving loan fund. So we've got a couple of cities, Bismarck and Grand Forks, who are now working on replacing their lead service lines. And there are other cities who probably will be ready to go very soon. Now, if a city is really strapped for cash, there's a way to forgive some of that loan. Find out more about that by going to the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality.
Dave, do you have a sense in cities and towns across the state that cities are keeping up with their infrastructure needs? They're behind. What's your sense?
My sense is that I think they're paying for it when they can, but I think there is an effort to really upgrade infrastructure now. And we've got some state money that's going to help, and we've got this revolving loan fund that's going to help.
Dave, Minnesota has now raised a new state flag. I want to ask you a couple of things about North Dakota's flag in just a minute.
That's right.
That's kind of a big story for our listeners that are in the Prairie region.
It's also been controversial. There are some people who did not like the new design of that flag, but they did hoist it now. It is now flying in Minnesota. And North Dakota, we've got our flag. And there's been, you know, some chatter about maybe looking for a new design, but nothing has happened yet.
Here's why I wonder about that. Everyone, I think, knows by now I'm from Wyoming, but when you look at Wyoming's state flag, there's no question what's going on in the state. The words are there: livestock, grain, mines, oil. Mm-hmm. It's all on our state flag. I look at North Dakota state flag and I don't get the sense of any of that stuff, even though most of it applies.
That's right. It applies. You do see a wheat field, a wheat chaff. You're not seeing anything much about energy on North Dakota's flag. So that's one thing that I've heard from some legislators saying, well, maybe we ought to take a look at that and try to add energy to it.
All right, Dave. Bird flu, it's on the radar. Danielle Webster has reported about this, our news reporter.
It is on the radar because it's a very highly pathogenic strain of avian influenza that's out. It's been widely circulating in both backyard and commercial poultry flocks. And in a few cases, it's rare, but it might get to humans. So there's surveillance on this right now. So far, North Dakota hasn't had many cases, if any, but maybe it's a matter of time because we are part of the flyway.
Yeah, just look up at the sky right now.
And absolutely.
You can certainly see the birds around. I wonder, Dave, with all of the issues around COVID, whether citizens will trust public health officials if this is to become a thing. Has there been any discussion about that?
Not very much at this point, but you make a very good point because of the whole COVID situation.
All right, Dave, let's go back to energy. A utility now has planned another gas-fired power plant here in North Dakota. What's the latest?
And this is a big one. He announced it at the Williston Basin Petroleum Conference in Bismarck. By he, I'm talking about the CEO of Basin Electric, who says they're going to build a 1,400-megawatt power-generating facility, and it will become the utility's largest power-generating facility. And he says it's the largest capital expenditure project Basin's ever done. And it shows that Basin is really trying to diversify its energy portfolio.
Where might this be constructed?
I'm thinking it's going to be probably up in the northwest part of the state because, of course, Bakken Wells, as oil starts to diminish, natural gas actually goes up. So, you know, the oil-to-gas ratio gets more toward natural gas. So there's going to be abundant natural gas there, and it's a good time then to build a plant like this.
Dave, I want to reach back to something we talked about last week. We didn't know yet what Governor Burgum was going to say about his direction to state agencies as they prepare their upcoming budgets for the legislature to consider. But he asked for belt tightening and asked for some reductions. What's the fallout from that ask, Dave?
There's been not a lot of fallout yet because they're talking about a 3% reduction in agencies that have a $10 million or more budget. So that's the big agencies. Maybe they can get by with some cutting here, some cutting there, but they don't expect any layoffs, and there's going to be an effort to get state employees some raises. And Governor Ruger made it very clear when he made this comment that, you know, they're competing with private industry right now, and everybody's looking for people. So you're going to have to do something about making sure that there's money available to offer a decent salary.
Dave, we've all seen on national news Governor Burgum showing up at President Trump's trial now a couple different times. Any chat about it and his comments that, you know, this trial's unfair, you've got to see it up close, and now you can see it's a scam. Anyone commenting about Governor Burgum showing up as a surrogate there for Donald Trump?
There have been commentary from the chattering class, so to speak, the people who are opinion writers. And I'm hearing some rumbling saying, you know, what is he doing this for? But the feeling is he's auditioning for a spot in the cabinet if Trump gets reelected. And I say reelected because he was elected, then he lost, and now he's running for election again. So if there's a second Trump term, Burgum wants to be a part of it. And he has also auditioned for vice president.
I'm wondering, though, Dave, about what is the rule of law when public officials comment about ongoing trials in this way? It's concerning to me. I've talked about it in my past life with members of the Wyoming Supreme Court and the Montana Supreme Court. And I think that it's interesting that a governor makes a comment like that.
Yeah, it was very interesting. From what I understand and some of the reporting we've accomplished and what I've heard is that because the president or the former president has a gag order, they actually can say some of the things that Trump wanted to say. I honestly think it makes everybody a little uncomfortable at this point.
Well, that trial will come to its conclusion here in the next week or so. So Lots more to report on about that. Dave, the June 11th primaries are coming up quick. What's the latest from the campaign trail?
Well, the race for governor sure has taken kind of a nasty turn.
Yep.
We're seeing a lot of ads, and there's a lot of money being spent on that race. We're starting to see that in the House, the U.S. House race, too. Rick Becker has been touting the fact that he's gotten endorsements from people like Rand Paul and Ron Paul and some of the what they call the Freedom Caucus members in Congress. And Julie Fedorchuk's received a pretty big endorsement from Elise Stefanik of New York. So watch that one. That's going to be interesting because there are other candidates who are involved. The spotlight is between Becker and Fedorchuk.
Of course, that's the House race as North Dakota's lone House representative. Dave, what's your team working on?
Well, we're going to be working on some stuff about the ads that have been shown. We're working on some political experts think about, you know, the advertising campaign. Does it make a difference? The old saw was, yeah, you go negative because especially if you're behind in the polls, it does work to an extent.
We've been listening to the news review with our news director, Dave Thompson.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story.
Dave, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
You bet. Glad to, Craig, always.
More Main Streets ahead, including a movie review with Matt O'Lean. Stay with us.
Billie Eilish wrote and sang about vulnerability for the Barbie movie. To make her new album, she had to let herself be vulnerable.
I finally got over the need to prove everyone wrong, and it wasn't about explaining myself, it was just about expressing myself.
New music from Billie Eilish and Finneas on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
And with that fanfare, that means it's time for our weekly trip to the movies with our in-house movie reviewer, Matt O'Lean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
This week's movie, of course, is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
So this takes place a couple centuries after the death of Caesar. So if you are familiar with the reboot of the franchise, which started about 12 years ago with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, War of the Planet of the Apes, all these things, which use what is called motion capture technology acting. So that is, you know, Andy Serkis kind of perfected that in The Lord of the Rings as Smeagol. What they do is they film the actors, and then they put the CGI ape stuff over them in post-production. So that's what they've been doing. It's different from, you know, you and I, Craig, are similar age. We grew up watching the Charlton Heston ape movies where actors were in ape makeup. And what John Chambers achieved with that ape makeup in 1968 is still phenomenal. Kim Hunter, Roddy McDowall, Maurice Evans in heavy ape makeup, which was phenomenal for the time. Now, it's less costly to do it this way with the motion capture technology acting.
It is amazing technology.
It's amazing. And let me just say that the VFX stuff in this is great. I mean, the detail on the main characters. So Owen Teague plays Noah. He's this ape that we kind of follow through this movie, and I'll get to the plot in a minute. But the detail on the fur, the eyes, is stunning. It is just amazing, Craig. And I think at some point one of these apes movies is going to win a visual effects Oscar. But the detail is stunning. It's like you're really watching a human being inside an ape costume, even though that's not quite what's going on. So I give the VFX people and the motion capture technology acting people high marks for this film. And that's really the key to these movies is the special effects.
And the VFX stands for virtual effects, correct?
Right. This is now a couple centuries after Caesar has died. And you remember Caesar from the films that when we were a kid, you know, he's the one that got transported to like 1972 United States. He could talk, and that's how the apes began to talk. So now in these reboots, you know, he's kind of the king. He's the one that wants to live with humans peacefully. Of course, there's always the gorillas that don't want to live with the humans peacefully. So now this is a few centuries after Caesar, and the apes now live kind of in clans, and they're scavengers, and there's little clans, and they're not really a united world. But there's another ape in the film played by Kevin Durand. He plays Proximus Caesar, and he's a bigger ape, and he wants to access human technology. That's kind of the key plot line. So Noah, played by Owen Teague, is this young ape who kind of lives with his family, and then, you know, all heck breaks loose. I won't tell you what's going on, but there's obviously something that happens that forces him on the run. He encounters a human on the way, played by Freya Allen. She plays this feral human who can talk, and her name is Nova. And if you remember from the first movie, Charlton Heston's girlfriend is Nova. So there's a nod to that 1968 masterpiece.
Some of the
music is similar to that Jerry Goldsmith score that we all remember. Kind of the visuals as they're on the beaches. It looks like that first film. It's a nod to that first film. Her character named Nova, played by Linda Harrison in the original, is a nod to that first film. So they keep going back to the genesis of the great Franklin Schaffner directed movie in 1968. So she's this human that can talk. The apes are stunned that she can talk because humans have been living basically a feral lifestyle since Caesar has died. So that's the plot. And Proxima Caesar wants to access human technology. And Noah is this ape. He kind of reminds me of Caesar. He's the good ape. He's trying to do the right thing. He befriends Nova. He sees the humans as not dangerous. And that's the conflict in the movie. So there's a lot of big set pieces, a lot of big action sequences involving rivers and fires and fights and things like that. William H. Macy has a cameo. So that's essentially where we are. And this film will set up further sequels. I won't tell you what happens, of course. We don't want to give plots away on this show. But it's going to set up further sequels with more humans coming in. That's how I kind of see it. So I like this movie for the most part. I think it's very similar to the other three, which were all really good. I think it's a little too long, and it's a little confusing. The first 20 minutes, you're kind of juggling balls like, who are these characters? What ape is this? Is this an ape I already saw? So it's a little tricky, but if you focus on Noah as the main character played by Owen Teague, you'll be okay. But I think the plot's a little confusing. It's a little too long, but overall, this is a solid addition to now, I think, the ninth ape film we've had. I think we're up to nine now. We kind of don't count the Tim Burton film with Mark Wahlberg, which was so bad. But I liked it a lot. It made $58 million at the box office, which proves if you've got a franchise, you can make money. And The Fall Guy did not have a franchise and only made $28 million its first weekend despite huge stars. So the lesson here for Hollywood, again, is franchises make money. Original stories like The Fall Guy, which was based on a TV show, they're a trickier sell. They're a trickier sell for audiences. So this is going to set up more sequels. Wes Ball, the director, deserves a lot of credit for the directing of this movie. And as I said, the star of this movie is the motion capture technology acting and the CGI. And like I said, the fur on the apes, the eyes are lifelike. It's really amazing.
Did the action overwhelm the more character-driven moments in this movie?
No, I think Wes Ball, the director, balances those well. We have a lot of big set pieces. Like I said, there's fires, there's rivers, there's apes crossing rivers, there's apes on horseback, which is always still an amazing thing, I think, from that first film, watching apes riding horses. I think Freya Allen is really good as Nova, you know, the human that can talk, that surprises the apes because they view humans as subculture, they're feral. And there's still this thing that kind of permeates all the movies, is that the apes can't quite believe there was a time when humans were running the show.
Right.
And that comes to fruition in those early films that we saw as kids. It's like, what? There's this past? Remember in the first film, 1968, Dr. Zaius keeps the secrets. He keeps the secrets from the apes that the humans once were in control. He knows Charlton Heston is from a different time, and he knows that he's a guy to be feared. He can handle that weapon. He's smart. He's Charlton Heston, right? And so Dr. Zaius was the keeper of the tablets, the keeper of the secrets. He doesn't want the apes to know that at one time they were in zoos, they were in jungles, and humans could talk. And that's kind of still permeates this, and I think it's setting up a pretty interesting sequel based on kind of a surprise ending you're going to get in this movie.
You touched on the music just a little bit earlier. I always ask you about it. Did you like the score for this movie?
Yeah, and as I said, they harken back a little bit to that Jerry Goldsmith score from the 1968 movie with Chuck Heston and Kim Hunter. So I always like the nod to the past because this all started with that amazing 1968 movie, which I think still holds up. And again, as we remember, Craig, that original movie has maybe one of the 10 best endings in movie history. And you know what I'm talking about, when Heston sees the Statue of Liberty. I mean, that's just an ending that no one can ever forget. Hard to top that one.
All right, Matt. You also wanted to revisit Roger Corman's life. He died last Thursday.
Yeah, he was 98, and this guy is an important person in movie history. He's the king of the B-movies, the king of pop movies. He finally got an honorary Oscar, even though he never had a sniff at an Oscar with the kind of movies he was making. He directed those Edgar Allan Poe adaptations with Vincent Price back in the 60s. But what he was known for was starting careers for other people. So if you worked for Roger Corman, Craig, you had 2 weeks to shoot the movie. Here's your budget. You better do this on time and on budget. That's how he worked. They were kind of like exploitation films like The Trip with Peter Fonda. That was a Corman film. Bloody Mama. You know, these kind of action exploitation films that Corman made. Not really exploitation, but entertaining movies. And he gave Francis Ford Coppola his first film to direct. Wow. Scorsese with Boxcar Bertha. Ron Howard directed his first movie for Roger Corman. Jack Nicholson, Dennis Hopper, Peter Fonda. A lot of these actors got their starts in Roger Corman movies. So his reach is enormous in movie history. And my favorite line of all is when Ron Howard directed his first movie for him in like 1978. It was a car movie. And he wanted more time or more money to do the movie. And Corman said, "This is the budget, Ron. This is the schedule. And remember, if you do a good job, you'll never work for me again." And what he meant was, if you do a good job, you're going to go on to bigger and better things. Coppola went on to bigger and better things with
The
Godfather
films. He must
have done
a good
job. He did a good job. Exactly. I love that line by Corman.
Let's go to our trivia question of the week. Matt, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes includes an actor who was nominated for an Oscar that locals probably remember.
William H. Macy as Jerry Lundegaard in Fargo.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. More Main Street is ahead. Stay with us.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 16th. May is National Historic Preservation Month, and today we look at another historic structure that relates to North Dakota's transportation infrastructure. The Grand Forks Airport was a dream of a few air-minded citizens in 1927. After a failed effort to acquire donated land for a memorial airport that honored the city's early citizens, the local commercial club continued the search. After inspecting a few sites with Charles Speed Holman, famed aviator turned general manager of Northwest Airlines, the group put $500 down on the land for the original Grand Forks Airport, 1 mile northwest of the city. After a law passed in 1929 that allowed cities to purchase land outside city limits for airports, Grand Forks completed the deal, paying $8,000 for the 160-acre plot, which was already under development and getting some use. Originally, three planes were located at the site, doing a taxi and amusement flight business. However, not even a decade later, the increased size of planes and the higher takeoff speeds made it necessary to enlarge and improve the airport. The city was hopeful that the Works Progress Administration would take on the estimated $250,000 project, which would make the Grand Forks Airport the largest airport in the Northwest. The airport essentially shut down for several years as the work was being done. In fall of 1941, a 21-passenger Douglas airliner arrived around 9 a.m., marking the return of airmail, express, and passenger service to Grand Forks. Celebrations ensued. Around that time, the WPA also began construction on a city administration building at the airport. It served as office space and airport terminal. However, between the increasing size and weight of aircraft, issues during the spring thaw, the expansion of the city, and the development of the interstate highway system, it became apparent by the 1960s that the airport should move. The administration building services were moved, but the building remained. It's now well ensconced within the city and is listed in the National Historic Preservation Register, standing as a testament of early aviation, city growth, and the changing transportation scene in Grand Forks. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
So many people loving that Dakota Datebook segment. In fact, we even get donations from people because they love Dakota Datebook. And before we close the show, we want to let you know you still have a chance to support Prairie Public and have your pledge matched dollar for dollar.
It's easy to do, Ashley. It's a quick phone number, 800-359-4145. Or people can go online at prairiepublic.org. But as you say, you give $5, we'll match that, or our fund will match that, and it'll really be $10. We would love for folks to pledge right now.
I'm a big fan of that member matching fund because I always like to say, no matter what you can afford, you can always afford to have somebody else spend that money too. So take advantage of these matching dollars by calling 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org.
Every dollar makes a difference to Prairie Public. Every gift matters. $5 a month here, $10 a month there, but we're going to match all of that today. That's why we hope that you can pick up that phone. Ashley's giving you that phone number, 800-359-4145, or go online right now to prairiepublic.org.
And don't forget, you get a chance to get tickets to The Moth, coming to both Bismarck and Fargo in November. Just a wonderful storytelling event. Online at prairiepublic.org or by calling 800-359-4145.
Well, Ashley, we'll wrap up today's Main Street. We are grateful that you had a chance to listen with us. Remember, there still is time to support the Spring Pledge Drive right here at Prairie Public. We would love for you to connect with us either online at prairiepublic.org or on the phone at 800-359-4145. Tomorrow during this time slot at 3 p.m. Central, The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. He'll ask the question, what can media organizations do to regain your trust? And at 7 o'clock, it's Science Friday with Ira Flayton.
And coming up Monday on Main Street, we go birding with someone who doesn't know very much about birding. But that is the point, to make it not competitive, to remember that you can just have fun while going outside.
Look forward to that.
Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.